Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. It's been a great series of talks that have been very diverse. I think one thing that has been highlighted is that we need to try to quantify the benefits for mitigation and adaptation for climate change. So this talk aims to do that, where I'm going to discuss the co-benefits from sustainable diets in relation to population and environmental health. So we've heard briefly that diets are a key link between population health and environmental sustainability. For example, food production and consumption are major drivers of greenhouse gases and land use, and lead to substantial adverse health, such as cancer and mortality. So I'm going to be talking further about that today. Importantly, the global food system cannot meet the nutritional needs of a growing world population, which is projected to increase to 10 billion by the year 2050, without irreversibly damaging the planet. This is assuming no mitigation efforts. Also, our current food system is not compatible with climate change mitigation objectives. So there's a problem that we need to address. Agriculture was responsible for up to 25% of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions and approximately 70% of fresh water use and more than one-third of cultivable land, in addition to other aspects such as biodiversity loss. So ultimately, we need to develop and promote healthy and sustainable diets. We need to transition towards the adoption of diets that are simultaneously able to provide adequate energy and nutrients while also minimizing impacts to the environment. One diet that has aimed to do this is the Eat Lancet Reference Diet, or the Planetary Health Diet. Has everyone heard of it? Anyone not heard of it? Not? Okay, good. It's received a lot of criticism, so I was hoping that maybe someone hasn't heard of it. So this was developed by the Eat Lancet Commission, in 2019. And their main question that they wanted to address is how to achieve a healthy diet that does not undermine the environment. So this is the diet that they came up with as a reference, as a reference diet. So essentially, we would decrease the amount of beef, lamb, pork, and chicken and poultry, as well as eggs, and increase the amount of legumes and nuts, increase the amount of fruits and vegetables, and whole grains. So here's the macronutrients per day that's suggested and the calorie intakes per day that's suggested. One way to estimate or measure the effects of shifting to sustainable diets is a concept called co-benefits, which is essentially a win-win situation. Co-benefits don't necessarily apply just to diets. They can also be other aspects of climate change adaptation or mitigation strategies, such as cycling, so you get active transport, which reduces the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, and also increases the amount of physical activity and health benefits from active transport. But with diets, essentially means the diets that improve both the health of people and the environment can lead to co-benefits. So if you have a diet that reduces the amount of greenhouse gases or land use impact or the amount of water use, and it also increases good health, then that's a co-benefit, both the environment and health benefit. So previous studies that have looked at co-benefits of diet have focused on altering specific nutrients. Reducing meat consumption has been widely studied. Adhering to various diets, such as the Mediterranean diet, or comparing different diet scenarios, such as the Mediterranean, pescatarian, and vegetarian diets, and considering different dietary scenarios to meet certain greenhouse gas emissions or environmental targets. However, these studies have been limited in that mostly have used aggregated data from country level. Diets have been assessed at a macro level, so they may look at, say, categories of meats versus vegetables, but diets are very, very diverse. So if you think about what you ate for lunch, your plate consisted of numerous things that came, that were prepared in different ways and came from different places. So it's important to get detailed dietary information. Typically, only one environmental footprint is assessed at a time, and most commonly greenhouse gas reduction has been assessed, which is obviously an important factor for climate change, but it's not the only environmental contribution diets. So co-benefits that meet both environmental standards and the complexities of nutritional requirements have not been holistically examined in using population cohort data. So to address this research gap, we took on a study, and the title of the study was Co-Benefits from Sustainable Dietary Shifts for Population and Environmental Health, an assessment from a large European cohort study. And this was a very large collaborative project with IARC and led by Paulo Vines, who you're going to hear from next. This project was conducted within the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition cohort, which is a population-based cohort with the initial aims to look at the role of diet, nutrition, and cancer incidence. And as you can see here, the European countries that are represented in the population. The aims of the present study were to investigate the associations of dietary greenhouse gas emissions and land use with all-cause and cause-specific mortality and cancer incidence rates, and to estimate the co-benefits for adhering to the Eat Lancet reference diet. So there were roughly 450,000 participants. We estimated greenhouse gas and land use contributions from almost 12,000 food items. So this is very, very comprehensive, detailed dietary data. And we estimated associations between dietary contributions to greenhouse gas and land use in all cause and cause-specific mortality and incident cancers using adjusted Cox proportional hazard regression models. To quantify the co-benefits, we used counterfactual attributable fraction interventional models to see what the effect would be if we altered individuals' diets to be more adhering to the Eat Lancet diet. So here you can see the on the y-axis, the bottom graph, we have greenhouse gas per kilogram of food per day, and land use represented meter squared per kilogram per food per day. And here we have each country. So sorry to say France isn't that good. But I think Denmark probably is a little bit worse in terms of greenhouse gases. But across all countries, it's the levels were quite high. And here is a figure that shows what the larger food groups that contribute to greenhouse gas and land use. So I'm sorry, the text may be a little bit hard to read, but not surprisingly, we see that meat and meat products contribute to a greater increase in greenhouse gas and land use, followed by dairy products. And here, the next food items, we get a little bit of difference between greenhouse gas and land use, so that cereal and cereal products, cereal cakes and biscuits, fats, and a lot of processed foods also contribute to greenhouse gases. Additionally, vegetables, alcoholic beverages, cereal and cereal products contribute to increased land use. So here are the results of the association between foods that were high in greenhouse gas and land use and mortality. So I'll talk about the all-cause mortality first. So essentially, for greenhouse gas and land use, when comparing the fourth quartile to the first quartile, you can see that there's increased hazard for all-cause mortality with foods that were higher in greenhouse gas and foods that had a greater impact on land use. Similarly, for cause-specific mortality, you can see that there was an increase in the hazard. For coronary heart disease mortality, cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, and cancer mortality. We also saw similar results for cancer incidence, though I won't present these today, but I invite you to read the paper further. So this is the distribution of the Eat Lancet score within the population. So a lower score means that they didn't eat like the Eat Lancet diet score. And then a higher score of 14 is perfect adherence to the Eat Lancet dietary score. So here's what most of the population were eating. And in this figure I'm showing on, we have here again land use in meters per square per kilogram of food and greenhouse gas per kilogram of food and the Eat Lancet diet score. So you can see that as you get closer, so if you eat more closely to the Elancet diet, there's a decrease in land use, and there's a decrease in greenhouse gas. Now here is the standard survival probabilities over a 20-year risk period. So the black is an Elancet diet score of 0, so that means that you didn't adhere to the Elancet diet at all. And then a 13 would be very, very close to perfectly adherence to the Elancet diet. So we can see that the probability for survival was greatest amongst those who ate more closely to Elancet diet versus those who didn't. And this figure is showing the co-benefits. So the bars in red and blue are greenhouse and land use, respectively. So as you get an increase in Elancet diet score, there's a decrease in land use and greenhouse gas, and there's an increase in the attributable fraction for preventable deaths and cancers. So essentially, depending on the Elancet diet score, up to 19 to 63% of deaths could be prevented, and 10 to 39% of cancers could be prevented over a 20-year risk period, which seems pretty good. Does everyone want to eat this way and prevent death and cancer? Yes. Some might be too good to be true, right? No. So the feasibility of the Elancet diet score, this is what we need to talk about. So this is the plate, typical plate that's suggested. So I told my lunch group table that I would pick on what we ate. So whose lunch looked like this? Primarily vegetables. A little bit of meat. Did anyone's lunch? Yeah. I think we did good today. Mine did not. Honestly, I had chicken. So that means that most of us adhered today to the Elancet diet, at least for lunch, which is pretty good in Paris. So if we look globally, though, not many people are adhering to this plate. So if we look at meat consumption, where this 100% is the boundary, which means ideally you'd want to be very, very close to it. We're 280% above the boundary for meat consumption, 293% above the boundary for starchy vegetables, and under the boundary for other emphasized foods such as fish, vegetables, fruit, legumes, whole grains, and nuts. And this is across North America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and South Asia, as well as many other countries. And here you can also see, so here's the region, global East Asia, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, Middle East, North Africa, Europe and Central Asia, and North America. So 100 is, again, the ideal for each. And you can see that we're exceeding with red meat, starchy vegetable, eggs, poultry, and then under the values for vegetables and fruits across many countries. So this is another demonstration of what an Elancet diet plate looks like. To make it look a little bit more appealing and appetizing. So looking at this, I think maybe we could adhere a little bit closer. The problem with this framing, and even with our study, is that we are framing it as a choice and a decision. So it's up to the individual to decide what to eat and what to put on your plate. And not everyone has that choice. So if we look at cost, a study in 2019 said at its most affordable, the median cost of adhering to the Elancet reference diet was $2.84 per day. This is in US dollars. Well above the global poverty line of $1.90 per day set by the World Bank. This means that the diet is out of range for 1.58 billion people who make up the world's lowest earners. And here's just operationalization of the Elancet Commission's targets. It's a very busy figure, but this was put forth by Coleman et al. In 2021. It's published in the Lancet Planetary Health, so if you wanted to look further. And basically they say that we need many steps for the operationalization of the diet, and it doesn't come from the individual. It comes from improved national governance of food systems, which includes investment in local and regional food systems, promoting healthy and sustainable diets through national targets, introduction of policies, development of equitable and sustainable food chains, and then this all feeds into raising social security payments, targets through food insecurity and food poverty. For example, changing schools' approach to a whole food system. So essentially, we need to make sure that everyone is able to access appropriate, healthy, and affordable food produced in ways that support the environment and nature while providing sustainable livelihoods for those working in the agri-food sector. So an environmentally sustainable diet will require a lot more than focusing on food production and consumption. The food system interacts with a variety of other systems in various ways. Thus, it needs to be embedded within various other systems, such as in the environment, politics, health, society, and economy. And just for those of you who are not familiar with the word food system, the UN's definition of the UN and Food Agricultural Organization, FAO, defines a food system as encompassing all the stages of keeping people fed, growing, harvesting, packing, processing, transporting, marketing, consuming, and disposing of food. It's not just one system, it's a system within systems. It's ecosystems, it's agricultural systems, processing systems, transportation systems, marketing systems, and much more. It's an interconnected web of resources, activities, and people, and the decisions they make that food gets to your table. So for example, if we look at sushi, people are eating sushi in Anchorage, Alaska, Chicago, US, London, UK, Paris, here, Milan, Dubai, and Bangkok. But when did a sushi become a global food, and how? And what systems are there? So we have to look very, very globally at our food system consideration and how we can make this more sustainable. Additionally, what's been questioned is the ability for the Eat Lancet diet to be for all populations. So for example, low income, low middle income, and the differences between these and high income countries. In 2013, the per capita meat consumption in high-income countries was almost 6 times greater than low- and middle-income countries. And animal-derived food products account for 70% of food systems emissions in high-income countries, but only 22% in low- and middle-income countries. Additionally, we don't know if this diet is applicable for children. So one study has looked at this. Well, they looked to see if children adhered to Eat Lancet diet. This was in Finland. So the black bars represent Eat Lancet target ranges for 3 to 4 year olds, and the gray bars represent daily mean consumption. So as we can see, for dairy foods and red meat, toddlers were above the targets essentially. And this doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing, because we have to consider the individual nutritional needs for growing toddlers and children and pregnant women and breastfeeding women. So the Eat Lancet diet didn't necessarily consider this, and those with also special dietary needs. Additionally, we have to think about country-specific environmental footprints. So a study in 2022, based on some modeling strategies, said that if all countries adopted the Eat Lancet reference diet, the water footprint would fall by 12%, which is really good. However, for some of certain countries, it would increase of up to 40%. So those areas that it would increase maybe don't have the increase in water availability. Additionally, the Eat Lancet diet, we don't know if it can work amongst climate change-induced agricultural practices. So imagine the scenario which has been put forth that in 2015, about 10 billion people would need to eat 25 grams of nuts per day, according to the Eat Lancet diet. It would require annual production of 82 million tons, increasing the current production by 540%. Considering that many nuts, including pictured here walnuts, are threatened by climate change, this target might be very difficult to meet. And this could also be true for other aspects of our diets. So we need to consider climate change projections in trying to also develop diets that mitigate and reduce the impacts of climate change. So I recently, this was a tweet, I think from this week, that the Eat Lancet 2.0 is being launched. So we'll see what they come up with next for dietary suggestions. And if you're interested, you can read the paper. It's open access. And with that, I want to thank all my collaborators in the study and my funding, which is through the MRC Center for Environment Health, that was, and those participants of the EPIC study, which the data came from. Thank you very much for your time.